Oh, what a goal.
That is absolutely superb.
Morning, gents. Afternoon. It's Thursday, not Wednesday. How are you?
I'm fine. It's sunny again in Stockholm after a few days of rain. So nothing better to do than sit inside and be on a podcast.
Who are you? I mean, where's Mark? Who's this gentleman with the intelligent? Ah, there he is. There we go. Welcome, Mark. I wanted to do
with the academic world is getting the better of my eyesight, and at 52, I've decided I've finally kind of given into my vanity.
Well, for those that are just listening on a pod, Mark is wearing his Clark Kent glasses and he looks way smarter. So if you want to check him out, you can check him out on YouTube. Britton, how are you, mate?
I'm doing well. Just, I think things are going back in this direction where we're coaching a lot and just being a little bit pressed for time. So I'm taking a call on the way to training. And I think I'll be using some of the ideas that we discuss here.
Yeah, I'm with you, gents. I mean, I don't know if you can see my rocking suntan. We've been back on the field for, for 2 days here. So it's been really, really busy. Yesterday was a 12-hour day. So I'm straight after this. I'm running out the door and we're off for another a long day of working with kids. So glad to be back. Not going to complain. Anyway, so this is going to be the last pod for a little vacation. We're going to take majority of July off and then reevaluate in August, just for anyone who's a regular listener. But before we obviously wrap up and have that break, we are going to talk about the constraints-led approach. And Britton, you are super curious about diving into this a bit more because you have a parents' meeting, I believe. Is that right?
So I'm delivering a talk to a number of coaches this evening on the East Coast in the United States.
Oh,
and I kind of bit off this piece where I wanted to discuss the kind of constraints-led approach and, you know, how I'm using it and kind of what my journey has been. And I want to give the best representation I can because I think as Mark mentioned in previous episodes, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what it is, and you know, just wanted to clarify a little bit what he means by that.
In Britain, if I put on a kind of a Salt Lake accent, maybe you could just mime to me tonight.
Yeah, I was thinking I could just, you know, the little bait and switch. You know, they think they're going to get Britain, but instead they get Robert De Niro's doppelganger in glasses.
God, I'm getting off. Oh, I'm really getting it today, aren't I? Very good there.
So constraints-led, obviously, Mark, you've been chatting and a lot of people have been reaching out to you as well just by the podcast and obviously your blogs, the tweets, and there definitely seems to be a confusion around what it actually is. So let's dive into it.
Yeah, it's kind of a lot of stuff that I'm going to bring up is very relevant to the previous podcast we had with the Dutch Federation, their insights, Jason's insights from Canada, Tony Strudwick, Martin Rothwell, Debbie at Salisbury Rovers in the UK. So we've had many discussions, even with the Australian FA last week, when we're speaking about the sociocultural and historical constraints on player development pathways. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and do a very, hopefully brief, synopsis of a constraints-led approach, but we kind of have to maybe dig a little bit deeper as well. So first of all, well, it's understood that human learning is nonlinear in nature. This also implies that our coaching methodologies that we use, the type of coaching we use, should account for this nonlinearity. But it's also important that our player development structures and pathways recognize this nonlinearity as well.
Mm.
Because really, when you think about it, the structure of development pathways, and the type of pedagogies implemented in these pathways, they go very much hand in hand. So for instance, if you're having a very traditional pyramid-like standard model of talent development where you have very early selection and selection and deselection up the pathway and the shape and in and out and in and out, then of course that's going to influence the type of pedagogy. And usually what you end up with is a lot of mature kids born early in the year, being in the best teams. And it's very, the type of pedagogies used are promoting very, they celebrate the very early maturers. So it's a lot of power and pace and
performance, isn't it? It's performance. Sorry? It's performance over.
Yeah, it's very performance. Celebrates this performance, not learning.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a very important thing. How the pathways and the pedagogies go hand in glove. That's great. I got a Smith song reference in there. That's good.
There you go.
So, like research has been calling for new models of player development to have them based on some sort of theoretical rationale. But the problem is that despite the research, the insights, even despite the conversations that ideas that the Dutch FA now are pushing forward, the Canadian FA, the ideas that even Tony Strudwick, who works at the top level, at the level of World Cup, at Premier League level, we've all been speaking about that. There's a continuous emergence of generic linear player development models based on unsound presumptions. And that performance in sport is just conceptually linear and predictable. So the problem we're faced with at the moment is that there's a sort of a path dependency that is driving these generic linear models.
Yep.
We're having a lot of coach-centered practices, very explicit feedback, explicit instructions, top-down, coach is king. There's a systems capture, it's called. We're doing things the way, because it's just the way we've always done them, this worked before. And we always go back to Jorg and Janema speaking about, the Dutch do it this way, so we must do it this way. And as they said, don't copy the Dutch, because it's very it's very in line with their sociocultural and historical context. So this is kind of, these generic linear models have led to a lot of misconceptions with regard to the learner and the learning process. So with the idea of, the idea that talent individuals are thought to possess the potential for a set of pre-required social, mental, and physical attributes and skills. So there's these assumptions, and we've known there is evidence that suggests that a lot of these environments can, not will, this is an important thing, can possibly lead to motivational issues, burnout, injury. And as was highlighted in the International Olympic Committee consensus statement on youth athlete development from 2015, the commodification of children, this premature professionalism.
Yeah.
And now, so why hasn't this really been dealt with? Well, the thing is that while research has called for models to deal with this non-linearity of human development, now the constraints-led framework has been one that has been proposed. There has been limited take-up, and in many ways I can understand why this is. I mean, changes is always a difficult beast. We've had even people from top federations and coaches and clubs. You know, we know that there's a lot of job protection going on when change is being brought up, instead of embracing change and seeing it as a learning opportunity. But that's a whole other discussion. So why hasn't a constraints-led approach maybe been more something that has, why hasn't this reached more coaches and more national governing bodies, even though it isn't a lot of national governing bodies, coach education framework, but it's been in general misinterpreted. So why? Well, first of all, we have to be honest, the dense language of these approaches is, doesn't really translate to practitioners. Mm. And there's a lot of misunderstandings of what constraints and approaches actually is, how you implement it in practice, and how it can inform your modern player development structures, pathways, models, whatever you want to call them. Mm. There's a failure to acknowledge that a constraints-led approach informs us how skills emerge. It does not provide a framework for designing learning environments. That's important. It informs us how skills emerge.
Do you want to dive more into that? Because I think that's where a lot of people, like they think it's a model, and they think that it's, you know, like as we've said, a silver bullet or something. So
yeah, they think it's a silver bullet, but it informs us how skills emerge in individuals. It also, well, if you want to, I suppose, not a very good way, it also informs us how bad skills emerge. So right. I get into this. So if a constraints-led approach views the mind-body environment as continuously influencing each other. Now, the three constraints that have been categorized in a constraints approach are the individual constraints, which would include height, weight, speed, motivation, emotions, unique physical, physiological, emotional, and cognitive attributes. Then there's a task, the specific activity to be performed. Then you have the environmental constraints, weather, surface, light, facilities, and this is also societal and cultural norms.
Right.
So this captures a variety of factors that limit or shape the capacity to develop expertise. So these interacting constraints limit or shape how we learn skills.
Yeah.
They can help develop, limit, shape. So, and these three constraints do not operate in isolation. They interact and evolve over varying timescales, forming each unique individual's development trajectory.
Yeah.
So this is, of course, quite complex.
Can we give an example, Mark?
Sure.
Can we give an example before?
I'm going to give some minutes. So first of all, constraints-led approach informs us how skills emerge in individuals. They don't provide a framework for designing learning environments, although they are part of it.
Right.
So if we think of, say, the example I gave of Pavel Datsyuk, the magic man Datsyuk, ice hockey player, played in Detroit Red Wings, won 4 Stanley Cups. Myself and a guest we have on the show, Vlad, were working on a research paper after doing a long interview with him and a very big historical document analysis. And what we're found is that when he was young, there was a scarcity due to the economic situation, so that's the socioeconomic constraints. Due to that, there was a scarcity of equipment. So they used to get a lot of hand-me-down from the military when they were young kids, and these were very much worn-out hockey sticks. So when you got a hockey stick, Pavel learned the value of equipment very quickly. But what he did was that he adapted his skills and his learning to these socioeconomic constraints, meaning that he actually learned to play ice hockey while protecting the stick and the puck. And he never did these slap shots. So his unique part, this is not a direct cause, but the socioeconomic conditions created the environment for Pavel's skills to emerge in the sense that he learned his skills by protecting the puck and the stick, knowing that if he broke a stick, it might be a while before he gets one back. So his unique, and what's he most known for, is this kind of Lionel Messi-like way and unorthodox stick handling.
Right.
I've seen quotes like, I've never seen skills like this before. So this is not like something that was taught from a coach. This is partly emerged under socioeconomic constraints. So that's just a very simple example.
Right.
But there is also the individual, the growing individual, and et cetera. There's other constraints. But that's just a very simple example. Another would be from when the idea that skills have history is, right. You know, players turn up at your training with a whole bibliography, experience, and opportunities offered to them up to that point in time. So I've come across at our club in AIK in my interviews with coaches where some players, when they're 15 or 16, we're looking at the type of decisions they're making. Say a player gets the ball out wide and has 30 meters space to drive into, but plays the ball into the center instead. And that's a fine pass, although the player is even marked, he still reaches the player. But we're asking why, I asked the coach, why does that player do this? And we investigated a bit deeper through further interviews with other coaches, and we found that as a 9 and 10, 11-year-old, and then he also went to another club, he was very much part of these young teams that were put through these predetermined passing patterns and training that they'd regurgitate in a match. So he was only just acting on this, and still. So this was like some sort of sociocultural constraint.
Yeah, he wasn't attuned to the space because he was.
No, he wasn't because, his skills have history. So so understanding this is understands why this emerges with certain skills, why he made this decision. Maybe we didn't think it was the best decision. Why is he doing this? So understanding this can help inform coaches how to design their practice. But anyway, so, and that there's another really good example, and I've asked Magni if this was, who's head of academy at AIK, it's okay to mention this. So hello, Magni, if you're listening. We had a player who was quite a good player, but he was being described as lazy. And this is about a year ago, year and a half ago, doing some video analysis. He was 15, I think, and saying that he was lazy. But Magni was quite astute enough to recognize that there's something else there. So he had a meeting with the player, sent the player to a doctor and to find out he had an iron deficiency in his blood.
Interesting.
Yeah, so he was on the bench already in his team and wasn't getting in. He was a very good player because he was lazy. But then just because of this diagnosis, he got the medication and now he's just a completely different player.
Didn't you give an example with a kid that was colorblind as well?
Oh, that was my classic. Yeah. This was the slap in the face. Like, I used this one. Yeah, this is about 12 years ago. I was coaching a team, a bunch of good young players. They're about 13 or 14. And, I had everything planned. Everything was perfect. Everything was ready. It's all there. Had the session set up. This guy kept giving the ball away. But some weeks he was really good in practice. Next week he's just giving the ball away to the opposition. And I couldn't figure this out. And I was really, he's not focusing. He's got bad focus. I was trying to find, So I spoke with him then. This was going on for a few months. And I spoke with him once after training. He says, why are we giving the ball away? He says, Mark, I'm colorblind. Severely colorblind. So basically whatever vests the players got on was a real constraint on how he played. So it was a bit of a slap in the face, and I tell you, a great learning opportunity.
Yeah. So Mark, I always use an example with when I'm doing Coach Ed, and tell me if this is something that maybe people can relate to as well. You know, if you have and this isn't absolute either, because obviously there's other parts of that person's life that we may not know of, but if you've got a child who lives, say, in a 15th floor building, mother is he's an only child, single parent. Not necessarily allowed out of the housing, but then you've got a kid who's in the same age, same team, who, I don't know, lives in the suburbs, has a back garden, has siblings. That constraint in itself completely can disadvantage one kid and give an advantage to the other.
Yeah, they both turn up your training with a different bibliography experience.
Because of the invitation.
And of course, then we're back to the idea of talent. We identify one kid as the talent and we assume that his journey will be quite linear.
Yes.
So what I'm trying to do to help, so if we understand that the constraints-led approach is not small-sided games, as it's been called in some, it's not game-based practices. It just is a lens to help to look through a frame that helps understand the emergence of skills in individuals. So, and how individuals behave and how they perform. So a good way of explaining this is, I like the name of our podcast, Learning in Development. If anyone's noticed, it's not learning and, it's learning in development, where development describes the continuous changes, physical, psychological, social, skill, societal, and cultural changes in the individual environment relationship. Learning is what the player does about it. As learning happens in the midst of all these development changes in real time and over multiple timescales. So learning in development. I think that's a good way to capture a constraints-led approach, that the development describes the physical, psychological, social, and cultural changes in the individual environmental relationship over time, while learning is what the player does about it in the midst of these development changes. Mm-hmm.
The other players, say opposition, teammates, coach, all represent different environmental constraints.
Yeah, they're part of the task. They're part of the game, so they're also part of the task constraints. They're distributed across it. So what I think what you're trying to get into now is that then, so how do we work with a constraints-led approach actually in practice?
Right.
So to capture the methodological nuances of constraints-led approach, we use what's called, what we refer to as nonlinear pedagogy. So we have some principles that underpin this, and that is, one is representative learning design. Does it look and feel like a game or aspects of the game? Key principles of information movement coupling are present in the design. You simplify, you don't reduce. And then there is, of course, the manipulation of constraints, the manipulation of task constraints, possibly. And I'll go into some of that examples in a minute here. Movement variability, repetition without repetition. Instead of repeating the same movement and two people passing each other, how do you form a bit of variation? You can just add an opponent in between. So there you have suddenly repetition without repetition. So this is, how we do this in AIK with parent coaches, how I'm working with it, is to help them implement these principles of nonlinear pedagogy. We've kind of created this very simple model for them. And it says that you can reflect on your training when you look at it, or afterwards say, okay, was there a ball? Was there opponents? Was there direction? And was there a consequence?
Right.
Now, a consequence means if we lose the ball and don't win it back, your opponents can score or something happens. Are all players active? Are we avoiding queues and long waiting times? And then the thing is the key information in this design representative of the game?
Right.
So ball, opponent, direction, consequence, all players active, and is key information representative of the game. So can give you some simple examples of how the manipulation of constraints in practice task design where it might become problematic. Now, the thing is that this is always, there's a gain and loss with every time you constrain. You know, if you're playing one touch, then there is a risk that the defending teams are two touch organize around the rule. So you've got to always consider this in your design. Now, it's important to say it's not saying it's right or it's wrong. I particularly try to avoid these touch limitations, etc. But maybe they are necessary. And that's up for the coach to justify. I've even seen two examples from UEFA B. One was where, and this is the problem I have with theme sessions. I think we should be really designing around principles of the game, and the principles we have is in possession, search, discover, exploits, gaps in space, are recovering the ball, minimize opportunities for the opponents to exploit gaps in space and win the ball. So we're trying to move away from themes, because in a lot of coach education it's theme based, and then you end up with some coach with their decides the different sections of the session, how long each is, and this is regardless of what's happening, regardless if there's any learning taking place, and then they have these predetermined coaching points, and they end up, my experience I found is they end up looking for these predetermined coaching points in the session, and they don't observe what's happening. So a very simple example is that there was a friend of mine doing a UEFA B, and they had given the theme overlap. So he designed this kind of constrained game, and was asked by the coach educator afterwards, are you happy with the amount of overlaps? And he said, yeah, I'm delighted. I thought we'd loads. And he goes, well, I only counted four. He goes, no, it was at least 20. And after discussion, it's one of the coaches I was mentoring at the time said to the educator, so you assume that the purpose of an overlap is to get the ball? And he's like, yeah, well, but then if the purpose of the design is for the player, the overlap, getting the ball, then the defending team, all they need to do is just stand out around him. The whole team can go over there. So for him, he was explaining the purpose of the overlap is to destabilize the defense.
Yeah.
Maybe if they move over, the gaps appear and you can play through them. If they don't move over, then you can utilize maybe the overlap. So that was an example that of how even in coach education, coach educators and their history of skills, their autobiographies are over-constraining coaches, even in education. So then we have the example of switching play, which is this two side channels, and I've seen this. You must switch from one side to the other before you can score a goal. Well, then the solution is that the defending team just stands in one channel.
That's right.
So instead of that, you can constrain the opposite side of the ball and try and, so if you want to work with a good attacking play, you must have a representative defending. So you could say to them, okay, if the ball is in this side, in this far channel out here, you cannot have any players in the channel on the other side. So you get this idea of the defending team moving over, so it starts to become representative. So they were just two very simple examples. And then another example, I've often seen coaches doing shooting practice and the focus is on the person shooting and there's a goalkeeper there, but really shouldn't the focus be on the information, which is the goalkeeper, you know, helping the young player self-organize his shooting towards the information, meaning the stance of the goalkeeper, is he moved a bit to the left or a bit to the right a bit more, is he a bit off his line, etc. So I've seen coaches often saying that's a great, you know, great shot. They just hit a smack at the keeper or something. When really, you know, I wonder if the keeper went away and bought a hot dog, would they even notice? So it's on the, again, the focus is on the information.
It's so, kind of interesting. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
So they're just, it's very simple. So really a constraints-led approach informs us how skills emerge. And it's a very powerful framework, and it is definitely, and when we and then how we implement it in practice is through nonlinear pedagogy, and it's really quite a powerful way to work. And this pedagogy goes hand in hand then with a constraint sort of can also inform you how to develop your I don't like to go structure. I don't even like that either. A player development framework that is sensitive to the non-linearity of human development.
Yeah.
So by understanding these individuals, how they are developing, looking at through lens of a constraints approach, you can actually build your player development model. And I would call it actually a player learning and development model.
Right.
For your club or for your federation. And maybe we can start dealing with a lot of the issues we're having at the moment where disease generic linear models are used, with the whole intention of finding unique people, despite we have very generic models. So very simple, a constraints-led approach tells us how skills emerge. It is not a game-centered approach. It is not small-sided games, but it is a powerful framework to help inform our player development framework and help inform how we design practice.
I think when you talk about like some of the misconceptions of it is because it's representative, the design of the session is inviting behaviors of what a normal game would provide. Therefore, it's assumed that it has to therefore be a game. And that I think it's like this all or nothing. And it's society in general, isn't it? It's a pendulum. It's the same with over constraining them.
Yeah.
You used that example. It's just the same if you're looking for players to dribble and then you tell them they can't pass forward, but yet that's the right decision. You've over-constrained the decision.
Yeah, you've possibly over-constrained. But again, It's like, if you look at the continuum at one, can we have the default setting, which is isolated skills and the assumption that they have to learn everything isolated before they play the game. And at the other end, we have just thrown a ball and let them play. And neither of them are probably ideal. And we're not saying you should avoid them. But what we're saying is that in between, there's a whole landscape of opportunities. I call them a landscape of affordances that you can help players try to explore and exploit.
Yeah. It's funny, Mark, we came back and obviously we've built our entire return to play. It's been an opportunity for us to reset, I think, the traditional approach, if you will, or the expectation, traditional perception of what a training session for youth players looks like. And we're only 2 days in and we've fully kind of adopted this approach. And the kids love it. I mean, they absolutely love it. They're having so much fun. I mean, I even had a chat with a bunch of 16-year-old girls yesterday who were out with us. And I said, so talk to me about these environments. Are these fun, like, compared to maybe what you're used to? How do these compare? And they were super honest. They're like, oh, man. I'm like, I can't stand dribbling around cones, this, that, and the other. So they'll tell you. And I think that's part and parcel is being vulnerable enough to ask them, because they'll give you the feedback and they'll tell you what they like, what they don't like.
Yeah, but then a constraints-led approach will inform you how these kids have been coached before.
Of course it does. Of course,
individual environment task.
And I think to that point, Mark, I think that's why some coaches actually abandon the approach, because the kids are not comfortable, and you have to be patient enough to know that, you know, their experience, their history, their habits don't necessarily naturally automatically make them feel comfortable, and therefore the coach, I think, goes, well, I'm asking these questions, I'm creating these problems, and they don't seem to want to, you know, be vulnerable themselves, because they're waiting for someone to tell them what to do. And then therefore they just literally give up on it. I've heard that several times as a coach educator, and it's just like, yeah, you're actually somewhat reteaching what a training or a learning environment looks like, and what and how they should feel when they go through that. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to not know the answers. But yeah, a lot of coaches, it's not one or two, a lot of coaches do say those first 2, 3, 4 sessions is super uncomfortable for them when they start to go this way.
Yeah, for coaches it is, because it's kind of almost, they're giving up to the control that they're used to. But they also, as in that coach educator who was looking for overlaps but didn't understand the whole concept of it, that was his. He was a systems capture. He was doing things the way they've always done it.
Yeah.
Hey, Mark, yeah. Can you expand on the benefits of facilitating self-organization as opposed to prescribing solutions?
Well, it's self-organization under constraints. Well, if you provide solutions, the player doesn't own the solution then. If you're given the solution, it's like we spoke about this with these very top-down, exaggerated game models you see with 8, 9, and 10-year-olds, where the passing patterns are practice and training and just totally regurgitated in games. But they don't own any of them. It looks great. They win those games, but they don't own it. They're not learning to play the game. They're learning a model.
Performance.
Right. So the I think we talk about this in terms of, you know, what if you can provide the solution, why is it important that we allow the room for self-organization? And I think it ties into some of the self-determination theory that you have.
Possibly, yeah, but that's also because there is an assumption that there's only one solution. And if you really want to go into it, there's, you know, we have ideas of biological degeneracy where the body can actually self-organize itself in many different ways to perform the exact same task. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, you're aware of this because of your work in the biomechanics group, and even in your gym,
yeah.
People of different shapes and sizes coming in, performing similar tasks in slightly different ways. But
I think about it every time we have a beagle, and if you know anything about beagles, they have an insanely strong sense of smell. That beagle is able to self-organized solutions to get to food in ways that you wouldn't believe.
Well, that's part of his individual constraints, his hyper smell. Maybe it wouldn't be good for humans, because maybe we end up smelling each other, we probably wouldn't be bothered hanging out with each other.
I always you know, come into conversations about, and the kids need to be taught this and that. You know, I have another dog that's a cattle dog that plays.
No, kids need to learn this. They need to learn how to learn. They don't need to be told.
Right.
This.
But
I think that's how you, if you want to say teach, is helping kids learn how to learn.
Right. And I think to Mike's point of asking players, hey, you know, how do you feel about this, you know, this approach or this, you know, practice or whatever, it's much more satisfying for us as human beings to self-organize, not to be micromanaged,
it's more satisfactory for us to be given opportunities to adapt our behaviors to find our solutions. But the thing is also, there's nothing wrong with a coach saying to, like that kid I was speaking about who wasn't exploiting the 30 meter space and something that's actually in the middle. Nothing wrong with a coach saying to him, you know, when you're in these situations, I think you should, you know, drive into that space with the ball, dribble into space. We're not telling him how to do it. You know, you're not telling him to dribble 2 meters, 3 meters, or 20 meters. You're not telling which foot to do it.
Yeah, it's knowing your athlete as well. Like, yes, you know, if they don't see the space,
what do they need to hear at the time?
Right. Can you attune their lens to first of all identify it's what, there?
Yeah, it's called you're drawing their attention to it.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, we've talked about guiding attention.
The focus of attention. You're educating their attention.
So for an educator, or a coach, or, you know, when we design these practices, how do we be more intentional about what learning will take place?
I missed that there because there's some noise.
Sorry. I'm next to the freeway, but yeah, sorry. So if we want to be, you know, if we want to be a little more specific or intentional about what we hope the kids will learn, does that come down to guiding their attention?
Well, I think that's a very important part of your job as a coach, is guiding children's, young players' attention to the essential information. But that's, you know, the thing is, if you have a kid, but that's also related to their capacities. Maybe you have a kid who is, I think I shared a YouTube video or a clip of some kid, he's only 8 at AIK during the training game, and he just flicks the ball over a guy's head. That was his solution, and he's kind of does this. I haven't yet to see him run past a player with the ball, but he's continuously getting himself into great positions by putting passes like that in all directions, anywhere, and between players and around players. He never goes past players with a ball.
But that's
him at the moment.
Yeah.
And he is, you know, and he is finding his solutions.
Right. But the art, I think, Britton, to your point about the guiding, it's using the different tools as a coach, knowing the player, you know, knowing what their background is, knowing what, you know, the environment, what's the environment maybe telling them, not telling them, and knowing how to then, you know, draw their attention so that they do see those invitations. I think this is again where, if we all keep coming back to all the episodes we've done, even this approach, there's no absolute answer to any of this.
You know,
it's so contextual to
yeah, you know, and we know we've had Bastian from Wilhelm, the Dutch club here. And he spoke about Van Dijk and Frenkie de Jong, which is really, and he was very clear about Frenkie de Jong. And now I saw an article in some English newspaper about scanning, and that scanning is the new thing, apparently. It's like we've been doing this through evolution for 2,000 years. Otherwise, we've been eaten by every animal that crossed our path. So this is kind of in our evolutionary nature, but it's not. And it's not what you look at, it's what you see. And then they speak about Frenkie de Jong and Ajax, but Frenkie de Jong was at Wilhelm until he was 17. And Bastian is very clear when he says that I can show you games when Frenkie was 15, 16, where he's struggling in the middle of the park against taller and bigger players, and he hardly gets the ball for a whole half. So his his ability to, if you want to call it scanning, taking information, is probably related to the fact that it was a survival mechanism in the game, that he was much smaller than the taller players in midfield. So he had to find a solution. And his solution was to be more aware of what was around him. And maybe that's what's happening now. So there is a social, cultural, historical constraint as to why this was happening.
Yep.
His skills have history as well.
I saw it, Mark. To be honest, we saw it about a year and a half ago. We were running with U12s, and every day we grouped the players for different reasons. It was sometimes it was birth month. Sometimes it was size. And on the size day, it was interesting. The big players were playing against big players, and the little ones were playing against little ones. And the technical qualities of the little ones was unbelievable. Their ability to see, taking information, find solutions. The bigger lads, when they were playing against just bigger lads and not the wee ones, what works for them usually is just basically being brute and running through players. They couldn't do it because they're running into kids the same size. They didn't have the solutions. They didn't have the history of...
Yeah, but that's your job as a coach. And looking at through the lens of a constraints-led approach, you will find out how certain, some of those big players, how their skills emerged.
Yeah.
Why they play this way, and your job then is to design practice and ideas and non-linear pedagogy can help you. So as you can maybe educate your attention to the more representative information and
help. But even the grouping is a constraint because you've even changed now the environment of who's in the environment. So they have to solve the problem different because they don't have the wee ones anymore to just blow past. So just having different people in it, the task's changed.
I mean, the thing is that we're back to the difference between performance and learning, which at young ages is.
And I think again, if you bring it back to culture and we circle this tight together in a bow, that's where the pressures on organizations, coaches, you know, parents and expectation on what's important, and this notion that, you know, performance is the measurement.
Sometimes it's just the simplest things, you know, with players like my colleague Magni at AIK, just understanding there was something up with a player, send him to a doctor, and then suddenly there's a diagnosis that can be treated very quickly, and then the benefits are quite huge. And that was just a very small, it's like any complex system, you know, it's like small inputs can lead to great big outputs, and great big inputs can lead to very small outputs as well.
Yeah, we had, Mark, I'll give you an example as well. We had a kid who was fatigued, saying they were tired all the time. We were concerned. There was conversation around, do we let this kid go? Because he was in it was 15, 16. He was in an environment that was pushing towards something else. And after having a chat with him, we found out that his parents were going through a divorce and they were fighting all night and he was up all night listening. We're very worried, very concerned. And once we understood that, obviously we had the conversation to connect with him. He turned it around. He felt better. I think he was very concerned, but yeah, we didn't have a clue of what was going on in his life. And that was a constraint in his world. His parents were going through a divorce and he was struggling to deal with that.
These things happen. They're, you know, it's part of non-linearity of human development and they do influence us.
Yeah.
One of the things that we're using at the club, and this is just after my experiences. We float kids throughout the age groups a lot. Like last night I had 02 boys. We were short a few players. I called whoever I could get out. 05 and 06 boys playing up 2, 3, 4 years just to give the 02 boys a game. Unfortunately, we've developed a culture here where the 02 boys tolerate 05 and 06 boys.
As they should.
Not only tolerate, but are inviting and inclusive. And the growth that we see that, you know, with players as a result of playing with older players is amazing. It's astounding. But we can always do that because then they end up forming are, you know, biasing their solutions to always, you know, deferring to bigger, faster, or, you know, stronger players to do the heavy lifting.
I don't know if we mentioned this, Mark. You said you've read this book as well, right?
Yeah, really, really good book. I think if anybody wants to read about the constraint-led approach, this is quite a digestible book, I think.
And it gives the origins of where it really comes from.
We stick a link up there. And again, it's very important. This is not a silver bullet.
No.
I guess anywhere there's a human performing a task in an environment, there is a constraints-led approach.
Right. But the coach needs to navigate and understand that in order to, as you say, bring it out, invite them into...
Tell us how skills emerge. You can tell us how great skills possibly emerge, or not so great skills, or why certain players are performing, why they're not performing, etc.
Well, lads, Britton, are you comfortable? Do you think you can deliver all that tonight? Can you somehow change your voice to Mark's?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think I have a pretty decent grasp of it. That would be great. When Mark mentioned that there were, you know, that it wasn't a model and that was there was a lot of misunderstandings about it, I immediately jumped to
it. Well, it is called originally it was called Newell's model. What I meant, it wasn't a player development model.
Mm-hmm. Right. I just wanted to make sure that there's something that I hadn't missed. Yeah. And this definitely kind of reinforces my understanding of it. But I think it's really important for coaches to understand how we coordinate solutions and, you know, keeping perception in action or interaction coupled as much as possible. And also, you know, understanding the constraints of the game, you know, as defined by the environment of, you know, the actual game of soccer. Mm. I think we want to see learning. We want to see learning because we want players to be performers and contributors, you know, within the match and gain the satisfaction. So in designing, you know, in designing practice,
I have a wonderful example that I think can help you inform your practice. And this is nothing to do with football. I had a friend years ago who had a child, a new baby, and the child had weak neck muscles, and they kept going back to the doctor. And even though the child was growing, neck muscles were not strong, and they were getting a bit worried. And after a few months, the doctor said, "Tell me about the home environment." So they described their home, and then they said, "And then there's a dog." And he said, "A dog?" He goes, yeah. "We took in a rescue dog just before the child was born." He goes, "Okay, and do you leave the child lying on the floor?" No, "We can't with the dog." So there you have it. That was the reason. So, like, you know, children, you know, they're on their stomach or on their back, and they're, particularly when they're lying on their back, they're lifting their heads. And that's exercising the development of neck muscles. It's an evolutionary process. So the child never got the opportunity. So skills have history even at that age.
Yep.
Where the child was never given the experience or the opportunity. So the child's biography had a limited experience opportunity of utilizing his neck muscles in the way children do. And then, so they dealt with this, and then within a few weeks, everything was okay. Mm. So there's a constraints-led approach as well, individual environment and task.
Mm. Cool.
A few years back, kind of came across this term of naive intervention. And I think the greatest examples of naive intervention are us trying to isolate skills, ignoring constraints that we might be unaware of that exist within whatever task it is that we're practicing. Yes. And you end up seeing, you know, responses like that, to where we're no longer playing soccer, we're no longer playing football. We've, you know, come up with some idea of, you know, what will connect, you know, eventually. These things happen in the game of football. Thus, we're working on football. Mm. Name games and things like that to try to get players to talk. But we have to talk in the game, so we're going to practice talking at practice. Interesting.
Well, boys, listen, it's been super, super enjoyable the last, three months plus. Obviously, we'll be in touch through social media and messaging and stuff. Enjoy your little break off, and hopefully, yeah, in the next 3 to 4 weeks, whilst we're out and about doing new things, we'll get new ideas.
Superb. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Love Brim. It.
Stay safe.
Well, there. Get back to these 06s. They need my time. All right, I've got the solutions.
He didn't listen to a word we said, Mike, did he?
No. Well, when you look like Rob, like you say, Rob De Niro, no one's going to take you seriously. So.
Okay, all guys.
Right. Ciao, guys.
Bye. Thanks.